Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Tuning in for this post-decision episode of SCOTUSCast, I'm your host, Nick Garfinkel. On June 23, 2021, the Supreme Court decided Lange v. California, a case which concerned whether the exigent circumstances exception to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement applies when police are pursuing a suspect whom they believe committed a misdemeanor. In a unanimous decision, the court held for Lange that the pursuit of a fleeing misdemeanor suspect does not categorically qualify as an exigent circumstance justifying a warrantless entry into a home. Justice Elena Kagan authored the majority opinion of the court. I am joined today by Clark Neely, Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute, Larry James, Managing Partner at Crabb, Brown & James, and Vikram P. Reddy, Senior Research Fellow at the Charles Koch Institute.
This is kind of a fun case. It's interesting. It's one of these cases where I think the immediate decision really just affects Mr. Lange, but I think it's got all of these offshoots and long-term ramifications about broader policy and cultural matters in society that are just fascinating to talk about. And we'll dig into all of it. But what I want to do first is just talk about the facts and the background behind this case. And then I'm going to leave it to Clark and Larry to really get into what was decided and what the opinion said yesterday. So the case starts in a really fun place, Sonoma, California. I'm sure many people have visited. You can have a good time there, but while you're having a good time and drinking all that delicious wine, you shouldn't be driving. Nevertheless, that's exactly what Mr. Lange was doing. He was driving drunk and he was cruising down the road. He was blaring his horn. He was playing his music extremely loud, and a police officer noticed this. Now, he didn't necessarily notice that Mr. Lange was drunk, but he noticed the horn blaring, he noticed the loud music, and sort of felt that from his time as a police officer, he thought something suspicious was going on here. He started following Mr. Lange. So he follows Mr. Lange, who drives right up towards his house. Now, the police officer begins to flash his lights and indicate shortly before Lange gets to his home that he needs to pull over. And there seems to be no dispute about the fact that, that he was indicating for Mr. Lange to pull over. And yet Lange pulls into his garage and the police officer wanders up to the garage and, you know, it's got one of those sensors. So instead of allowing the garage door to close, waves his foot underneath, allows the garage door to pop back open. And he goes inside to have a conversation with Mr. Lange. And of course, the first thing he smells is the overwhelming smell of alcohol. In fact, Mr. Lange was three times above the legal limit. So he got busted for DUI and also for a minor noise infraction. But Mr. Lange went to court and challenged the evidence that was collected inside the garage because he said, that police officer entered my home without a warrant. Now, of course, the response from the police officer was, you don't always need a warrant to enter somebody's home. There are various exceptions that allow people to, that allow police officers to enter a residence. And one of those exceptions is exigent circumstances, meaning a chase. If somebody is trying to evade arrest, if they're trying to get away from you, it's not a game of tag. They can't simply say, oh, I'm home now. You can't get me. It doesn't work that way. That's an exigent circumstance. Now, here's where things get really interesting. It's Lange's counterargument to that point. Lange says, yeah, exigent circumstances do exist. They are recognized in law, but not every single chase or evasion of arrest counts as an exigent circumstance. Some do, maybe even many do, but there are plenty of exceptions. For example, if the crime that the person is suspected of is merely a misdemeanor rather than a felony, do we really want to authorize police officers to enter people's homes without warrants simply because they're going after somebody for some minor misdemeanor? I mean, we have thousands upon thousands of criminal laws in this country for all kinds of minor things, using the wrong light bulb or toilet or what have you. The idea that you could have a police officer enter your home just because you're suspected of violating some kind of minor misdemeanor, it seems absolutely ludicrous. This is Lange's argument. Of course, you know, the police officer counter argues that, look, evading arrest is evading arrest. The law, the state has an interest in ensuring that people don't run off from police officers whenever we're asking them to pull over. And this essentially is the essence of the dispute here, is whether or not you can establish a categorical rule that in these cases, a high-speed chase or, you know, trying to track somebody down who's evading arrest is always an exigent circumstance that allows a police officer to enter the premises without a warrant, or whether or not, or whether it may just be something you have to evaluate on a case-by-case basis. This is what the court had to ultimately decide. And they heard the argument, I guess, last February. It was February 24th. The three of us were on a Federal Society call talking about the argument, and they issued their opinion yesterday. And Clark, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about what exactly the court decided about that question.
Well, thanks, Vikrant, and thanks to Larry. It's good to get the band back together. I think this will be a really fun discussion. It is a fun case. It's a really interesting and fun case. But there's a lot at stake here, too, because we don't really know exactly how many misdemeanor arrests there are in the United States every year, but it appears to be north of 13 million. And about 80% of all arrests are for misdemeanors. So it actually comes up a lot. Now, how many of those involve, somebody fleeing the officer is a separate question, but certainly plenty of people in America find themselves being arrested for alleged misdemeanors. And so it's an issue that has real significance. Now, Justice Kagan, in writing the majority opinion, starts where one ought to start. First, with the question of whether the court's previous case law, obviously the text of the Fourth Amendment does not supply a clear answer here. It simply prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. And so it's not granular enough to tell us or to provide an answer in this case just based on the text of the Fourth Amendment. So where do you go to next? Well, you go to the court's case law and you look there to see if the question is answered. Justice Kagan and the other justices, it's a joinder opinion, conclude that the existing case law does not answer the question, although Chief Justice seems to think that perhaps it does, or at least provides more guidance than Justice Kagan seems to believe. Next question, is there a clear common law rule? Can we look back through history and see how courts handled this question in the past? And does that supply an answer? And again, Justice Kagan reviews the past holdings of other cases, including in England and commentators, and concludes that history does not supply a clear answer to this question. Then you get to, I think, is really the interesting part, right? Which is, where then do we start? What value do we start with? Do we start with the importance and the value of facilitating law enforcement on the one hand, or do we start with the importance and the value of the sanctity of the home on the other? As a constitutional litigator, I think this is a really fascinating and incredibly important question, because you can play a little bit of a game here, basically in the way that you assign the burden. Which party has the burden, in effect, of vindicating its value or its interest? Now, normally what the Supreme Court does is it grants the legitimacy of whatever it is that the government is doing. In most constitutional settings, in effect, there is a presumption of legitimacy. The government gets to do whatever it wants, and it's incumbent upon the citizen to demonstrate that the government cannot do the thing that it wants to do in a particular case. Justice Kagan actually does the unusual thing here, which is to start with essentially the presumption is in favor of the citizen, not the presumption, but the starting value is the one that is being advanced by the citizen, which is what? It's the sanctity of the home. It's having a place where police cannot intrude without without getting either getting a warrant from a neutral magistrate or demonstrating the existence of truly exigent circumstances. But the default setting, and I strongly agree with this, with Justice Kagan, is the sanctity of the home, and it's incumbent on the government to demonstrate that some exception to the Fourth Amendment permits the officer to enter the home without a warrant. And in Justice Kagan's view and the view of the justices that joined her opinion, that showing is was not, well, the case was remanded to the lower court to apply the new standard announced by the majority. But Justice Kagan finds that there is no reason to impose a categorical rule that flight or the attempt to flee from a pursuing officer is always or nearly always a sufficient exigency to permit a warrantless entry. And that's going to be the big disagreement between Justice Kagan on the one hand and the Chief Justice in his concurrence, as I'm sure Larry will tell us about in a moment. So essentially what Justice Kagan does is say, look, we start with the sanctity of the home and the requirement of the Fourth Amendment imposes, which is to either get a warrant or demonstrate the existence of truly exigent circumstances. And flight alone is not a sufficiently exigent circumstance to justify a warrantless entry as a general rule. Instead, it is going to be or should be treated as one factor among others. There are any number of factors that can create exigency, and they can operate together. There can be the seriousness of the alleged offense, the risk to or potential risk to the public or to the officer who wants to gain entry to the dwelling, the possibility of destruction of evidence, the possibility that the fleeing person will be able to go inside the home and then disappear in some way. So to summarize Justice Kagan's opinion, we have basically an analysis that says the text of the Constitution does not supply an answer. Our prior case law does not supply an answer. And looking back at the available common law historical sources doesn't supply an answer. What we do know is that the Fourth Amendment was designed to protect the sanctity of the home. So that's the value that we start with. And we require the government to demonstrate a sufficiently compelling reason to enter the home without a warrant. And they may actually, the case, as I said, is to be remanded. It's remanded to the lower courts to apply the new standard. So it is possible that the government and the police officer will be able to make the case that there was a sufficiently exigent situation to justify the entry into the Mr. Lange garage. But that will be a case-specific inquiry that will be undertaken according to this framework that the court announced today, which is that when somebody flees a law enforcement officer who's trying to arrest them for a misdemeanor, the fact of the flight is simply one factor among others that may or may not create exigency. So the case is not over. We don't know exactly what the outcome is going to be, but we now know what rule, what framework will be applied by the lower courts to decide whether or not this particular arrest was valid under the Fourth Amendment.
So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Larry James, General Counsel for the National FOP. It's a privilege and pleasure to be with the gang again, and thanks to the Federalist Society for convening this. First of all, there are over 800,000 law enforcement officers in the country with arrest powers, and they're making in excess of, as Doc said, over 13 million arrests a year. I think the only thing we can take from this case, and I think this is why the Chief Justice wrestled with this, is the court said there is no absolute rule that in a misdemeanor pursuit that you have the authority to go in and search a home or invade a home without a warrant. I think the Chief Justice really made that point of saying that, look, if you're pursuing someone, that in and of itself is grounds to go into the home without a warrant. The Justice Kavanaugh and all the concurrences, they took a different slight, but at the end of the day, they all agreed. And I think the general consensus was, how do you, as Clark said, what is the standard to articulate, even going back to the trial court? And I'm not sure the trial court is going to have any greater guidance. And maybe they'll take additional evidence to try to narrow that point. I was asked what my thoughts were that, you know, to take away from this case in light of the majority opinion, the concurring opinion, and particularly the Chief Justice's take. And I said, when the situation warrants immediate action, take it. If it doesn't warrant immediate action, get a warrant, search warrant. And I would stop there because I think the intriguing thing, if we were to ask each other, if we're the trial judge now, in light of this decision, how would we rule? So I kick it to our team. Would we sustain the conviction? Would we grant the motion to suppress under these circumstances?
The crowd, what do you think?
I'm still not sure. You know, this Larry challenged us just like this when we did this back on February 24th. You know, if we were the court, how would we have decided this case? I'm still not entirely sure. I actually like the answer that you gave, Clark, when Larry challenged us like this back in February. And you said, look, whatever the answer is, it has to somehow recognize the centrality of liberty in the American legal system. And that doesn't mean that it's the only value we have in the American legal system. There are other ones. But liberty is a value, and it's a very important value. Not every society is constructed that way. There are plenty of societies, even developed Western societies, that don't really place liberty very high on the value list. But America does. And the judge, you know, who ultimately has to hear this case again, I just hope in some way recognizes that. And I do think, by the way, that the Supreme Court recognized that. And I even identified this line in the chat box that really stood out to me from the court's opinion today, where I think the court was trying to explain that while they have a lot of sympathy for the needs of law enforcement, the value of liberty has to be the guiding force behind how this case is analyzed and decided.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm so glad that Larry asked this question because it gives us an opportunity to discuss something that I think is very challenging. And that is, if you're going to try to answer this question as conscientiously as possible, if you're the trial court judge, is it incumbent on you to attempt to place yourself behind the veil of ignorance about what the result of the warrantless entry was, right? Because on the one hand, we could imagine a number of counterfactuals. What if the officer had entered the garage and discovered a body or multiple bodies or a bunch of people being held prisoner, you know, who were kidnapped? It's very difficult, I think, for most people to imagine that under circumstances like that, where it's a very close call, that you as a trial judge are going to rule in a way that could result in the exclusion of that evidence and the loss of opportunity to convict this person who's, you know, a kidnapper or a murderer. On the other hand, we could imagine a situation where the warrantless entry into Mr. Lang's garage discovered nothing. And I would be inclined under those circumstances to say, look, you know, this guy was playing his music loud, and you tried to pull him over for that. He may or may not have seen you when you activated your lights. And for that reason, you get to storm into this guy's home without a warrant? I don't think so. And of course, the real facts of the case put us kind of in between somewhere,
right?
You know, which is that this guy was appears to have been seriously impaired. At three times the limit, it's hard to imagine he wasn't a hazard to other people. And of course, thousands of people are killed every year by drunk drivers. And so this is a genuine public safety concern. So I'm struggling with it. And I think that, I suppose the answer to my own question is that you probably should try to get behind the veil of ignorance if you can. And if I could do that, I would be inclined to say that that this was an improper, that this was a Fourth Amendment violation because the circumstances that we knew about at the moment when the line was crossed, so to speak, when the officer made the warrantless entry into the garage, I just don't think that the conduct in question was serious enough that it should support allowing police officers to barge into people's homes. And, you know, there were some great descriptions of situations from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyer amicus brief in support of the cert petition. And there have been some real tragedies where police have stormed into a home in pursuit of suspected misdemeanors. I forget if there were any deaths, but, you know, there was one case where they pursued a college student into an apartment because they observed him, you know, relieving himself on the patio, and a huge brawl ensued. And I believe that the resident, the person who lived in the apartment, who was the boy's girl, the defendant's girlfriend, pulled a gun. So there are real concerns on both sides, and it's a hard question. And I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but I suspect that it depends a lot on whether the judge decides and succeeds in putting him or herself behind the veil of ignorance.
So things. Number one, the case doesn't change fleeing felons in the pursuit. And that's number one. Number two, I think this case is, if I'm looking at it, I need additional facts, because the facts of the case, are not complete. You look at a situation, was the individual weaving? What was the danger? Let's expand on whether whether Lang actually saw the car, saw the lights, and ignored it, and was back fleeing and caused a risk in a safety situation. I think the other thing is there, you know, the court made it implicitly clear that this is not an absolute, as the trial court had determined. So from that standpoint, I agree with the court to send it back. And I think for that reason, it has great weight that if there are those jurisdictions that want to say a fleeing misdemeanor, it's an absolute, you can follow him or her into the car. So I think that's a safeguard that the court imposes. And I think this idea of the minor misdemeanors versus the minor felonies, how do you distinguish those? But I think the court gave some clear direction of saying, go back, you know, because lawyers are going to file their motion to suppress. They're going to hold the hearing. And I think you can probably establish a sufficient record that says, under these circumstances, the police officer was not racially profiling or doing anything illegally or invading that the privacy of the home. So I looked at it as a little bit more simplistic. As I said earlier, if it's an immediate situation that poses a danger, the officer assesses that risk on the basis of his or her training, his or her experience, and says, I need to take action. And I think that in this situation, there were a couple additional circumstances when the officer put his foot and the garage door goes up, he has a conversation, then Lang steps outside. And it's at that conversation that the arrest is made and things of that sort. And we really didn't have any discussion on that point. But I think what it goes back to is officers, use your judgment, use your experience, use your training. One of the examples, I shouldn't say one of the examples, but usually when I have these cases on these type of procedural grounds, I'll take a sample of officers and I'd say, what would you have done in this case? And I had six officers and they were split 50-50.
You know, Larry, one thing I want to note, I like your immediate need versus non-immediate need formulation better than I like the felony misdemeanor formulation, which I can't remember if Kagan writes about this in her majority opinion, but during oral argument, I definitely remember her bringing up the point that this felony misdemeanor thing that we're all harping on is not a very useful rubric. You know, there are some very, very serious felonies, like, you know, Bernie Madoff type things that are worth millions, even billions of dollars, but they would not justify a police officer entering a home. On the other hand, there are misdemeanors like domestic violence, which it's a mere misdemeanor, quote unquote. And yet it probably absolutely does justify a police officer entering a home in order to protect the life of the person behind the door. So the felony misdemeanor Fisher, it's just, I don't find it a very useful construct. The one you're putting together seems a little bit more sensible to me.
And I thought, I was looking for the court to say something like that, because if you use the immediacy of it, you know, you can ask the question and you ask the officer, officer, if you had not taken action, what was the potential risk and harm of going and getting a warrant? There was nothing about evidence. This was simply an erratic, at the worst day of driving, the individual was driving. And at that point, the risk and the immediacy had been terminated. So I like that, you know, that's something I just came up with saying, as I'm telling our officers, this is the criteria that I was imposed on myself.
So there's a, I think there's a very interesting kind of elephant in the room here, and that is to pick up on what Vikrant said a moment ago. Misdemeanors, even if we were satisfied with, you know, sort of the felony versus misdemeanor, you know, dyad, which we're not, misdemeanors run the gamut. From really serious conduct that presents a real threat to individuals and or to society, all the way to the utterly preposterous. You know, Justice Kagan gives some examples in her opinion that include littering on a public beach and artificially coloring live chicks or rabbits. And, you know, sometimes a police officer will be attempting to arrest somebody for a serious misdemeanor like drunk driving or, you know, assault. And other times they might be trying to arrest them for something completely preposterous, like smoking marijuana, which I understand happens a lot. And that I think is sort of the, I suggested there was an elephant in the room because we don't always know whether there will be anything at stake for society in ensuring that the officer is able to make the arrest. And we also know that there may be some instances where what's really going on is the officer is kind of initiating a fishing expedition. What they're really doing is they're wanting to investigate and see if, for example, if I can get close enough to this guy, will I smell something on his breath or in his car that will then lead to, you know, something more substantial than he was playing loud music. I mean, imagine if this officer had you know, tried to call and get a warrant to enter the garage because the guy was playing loud music. One can only imagine the judge would say, are you kidding me? Like, especially if it was like 2 a.m, which it wasn't. But what if, well, you got me out of bed to get a warrant because some guy was playing his music loud? Go find some police work to do. So I think that's another point here that's worth mentioning, is that we know that in many of these instances, if the police are not able to gain entry in the residence to effect the arrest, they're just going to go away. They're not going to pick up the phone. They're not going to try to get a warrant because they know that there's the conduct at issue is so ridiculous that, you know, they just basically wanted to write a ticket, maybe make an arrest, maybe get some credit for making an arrest or writing a ticket. But if it's going to be a hassle, if they're going to have to involve the judiciary, they're just going to let it go. Now, that's the theory. I think the reality is that virtually every police officer is going to take Brett Kavanaugh up on his offer. I think it was barely a tacit offer to just go ahead, make the warrantless entry. Don't worry about it. Because at one point, Brett, in his short concurrence, Brett Kavanaugh says, Justice Kavanaugh says that he notes that the Lange's counsel conceded that 9 times out of 10, there will be a sufficient exigency to excuse the lack of a warrant. I view Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence as virtually an invitation for police to just simply make the entry every time and don't worry too much about it. We will usually have your back. That, I think, is likely to be the practical result of this case. Call me cynical, but my guess is that's what it'll be.
That is a jumping up and down disagreement. Because I think the majority of officers, and, you know, I think we're, that's why I started out. I said, we have 800,000 officers and over 13 million arrests a year, give or take a few. And I think, you know, if you have those situations where an officer has run amok and there's a motion to suppress, trial judges, more often than not, are going to suppress that evidence. They're not going to let it in. That's number one. Number two, you may have these circumstances. In your example, the officer smells marijuana on someone, or he or she's running, you know, in the beach area, and the individual they observe is intoxicated. An individual goes to get in their car, and they have a pretty good probable suspicion that the individual is incapable of driving and should intervene in those sort of things. I guess I have confidence in our officers, and I take what this case has said, and I think it helps us and it gives guidance that there is not an absolute, irrespective of what Kavanaugh said, that you cannot, under these many circumstances, go in and have a warrantless search. So that's the takeaway from that. I think it'll be interesting as we go back to the trial court, and maybe we should do this when the trial court holds its evidentiary hearing or rehearing on these points. And I think as we put on our seminars around the country, before even this case came out, when it first came up, we have said probably most officers would not have done what this officer did, irrespective of whether it being legal or not.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.